Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Tony Horwitz, author of Spying on the South, An Odyssey Across the American Divide. We'll also hear from Brian Camp, whose new Crescent City novel is Gather the Fortunes. Tony Horwitz travels the world looking for great stories. He's been a foreign correspondent, won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting, and wrote for The New Yorker. His best-selling books included Confederates in the Attic, Blue Latitudes, Baghdad Without a Map, and A Voyage Long and Strange. Today we're talking about his new book, Spying on the South, An Odyssey Across the American Divide. Tony Horwitz, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us about reading the work of Frederick Law Olmsted and then setting out in his footsteps.
Frederick Law Olmsted is generally regarded as America's greatest landscape architect. He designed Central Park in New York and dozens of other sites around the country. But few Americans know that he had earlier renown as an undercover reporter for the New York Times on the eve of the Civil War, touring the South. And he then packaged his journalism into several books that became staples of scholarship on the region. And I was assigned one of them in college and rediscovered it a few decades later and was just entranced by his writing and his insights and thought, heck, I'd like to take a parallel journey with Fred as my guide 160 years later to explore what he saw then and what I would see in the present at another time of national division.
Which is a sign that you should not throw away those college textbooks, obviously.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's a definite tie between Olmsted and New Orleans. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, very late in his career, he was approached about designing a park in New Orleans. In the late 19th century, an Olmsted Park was almost like today owning a professional sports team. It made you a big league town. And unfortunately, he wasn't able to do the work himself. He retired soon after. But his sons carried on the work very much along the lines that Olmsted would have done it, his aesthetic and social philosophy. So Audubon Park is the result that obviously well known to people in New Orleans. And so, again, it's not technically a Frederick Law Olmsted Park, but it's an Olmsted Park.
Now, you've traveled in some famous footsteps. You followed Captain Cook in Blue Latitudes, the Vikings and conquistadors and early discoverers of America in A Voyage Long and Strange, the Australian Outback, the Keystone Pipeline. So it might seem that following in Frederick Law Olmsted's footsteps would be a little tame, but that was not at all the case, was it?
No, and that was another reason I was drawn to taking this journey. He had a tremendous sense of adventure and kind of a subversive spirit. He kept straying from his journalistic beat, which was really primarily agriculture, to just go wherever his curiosity took him. And he describes that in vivid detail, and I tried to travel in the same spirit, with my eyes always open for whatever strange or unexpected encounter or experience might come my way. So, yeah, I saw some things I didn't expect and had some experiences, not all of them pleasant.
I know.
Yeah, even though I'd spent a good deal of time in the South, it was still very fresh for me, particularly because I followed the path of his second Southern journey, which took him to parts of the South I was much less familiar with.
Well, there are a number of places that were significant to Olmsted in Louisiana besides Audubon Park. You visit Colfax, the site of the Colfax Massacre, which many of our listeners will know from Lolita Tatamy's books.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an eye-opening experience for you.
Yeah, Olmsted visited plantations there owned by the Calhoun family that were, as he wrote, the largest, most profitable, and cruelest of any he visited in the South. And this led to a very bitter legacy, as people in Louisiana know, but not much outside of the state, of this horrible massacre during Reconstruction of African Americans. And what was so striking today is that obviously there's been tremendous change in the South over monuments in particular. But in Colfax, when I was there, you still have a monument with the words white supremacy on it, hailing the three whites who died in this fight in 1873 for defending white supremacy, and a state monument or plaque put up praising it for ending carpetbag misrule in the South. So it was kind of striking to see that tone still taken in how we remember our history.
So the American divide is not so undivided?
Depends where you are. I mean, I think, you know, you can't really talk about one South as you can't talk about one North or one mm-hmm. America. You have to talk about the urban South, the rural South, the white South, the black South, the immigrant South. These are all elements that combine to, you know, make up this tremendously diverse region. But I would say certainly in more rural areas, I found far less had changed since I reported Confederates in the attic 20 years ago than was the case in places like New Orleans or Nashville or Houston or other large cities.
And on the lighter, if perhaps dirtier side, you attend the third annual Mudfest.
Yeah.
And in that, you're in pursuit of an element of Olmsted's travels, the mud he complained about. So I think you were very brave to venture into Mudfest.
Oh, it was, I'm not sure what to call it. Not quite a pleasure, but an experience. Yeah, whenever possible, I wanted to travel as Olmsted did or mirror his experiences. And he wrote a lot about mud in every place he went. And bizarrely, one of these massive sugar and cotton plantations he visited is now the site of the nation's largest mud fest, which is basically a demolition derby of monster trucks with a heck of a lot of drinking and stripping as well. it's a rather X-rated scene. And so, you know, I rode and trucks with people and drank a lot of moonshine, and it was one of the more challenging experiences to take notes on, because you're bouncing around in a monster truck and not entirely sober. And by the end of my time at the Mudfest, my notebooks were filled with mud and spilled drink and other things.
And we should say you arrived at the Mudfest in a monster Kia.
So. Came woefully underpowered in a rented Kia, not the best vehicle. So, yes, parked that and hitched rides on the monster truck.
Now, one of the most wonderful sections of the book to me is it's just so much fun to read. And it's a true story of man against nature, or otherwise man against mule. And you're in the wonderful Texas Hill Country in Bandera, the cowboy capital of the world. And I'm so glad to hear the old Spanish Trail diner hasn't changed a bit. So tell us about your experience in Bandera, which is my favorite.
Yeah, I went there because Olmsted actually rode across Texas, some 2,000 miles of it. And he had horses, but also a mule. And I thought, well, you know, why don't I try and do at least part of that, to have that experience too, in the hill country, which was his favorite part of Texas, beautiful area. And I was told that the place to find a guide was in this cowboy capital of the world, Bandera, which is just this wonderfully colorful sort of old west town that was one of the first places they had dude ranches back in the early 20th century. So I wandered around to all these ranches trying to find a guide without success. And then someone told me about what she called a mule man extraordinaire, who would take me out on an extended mule trip. And I tracked him down, and off we went for 3 or 4 days riding and camping in the hill country.
And how did he live up to your stereotype of a cowboy?
Yeah, he turned out, unfortunately, to be really a cowboy Captain Ahab.
Yes.
Realized that when we set off. And for reasons that were never entirely clear, he just wanted to make me absolutely miserable and berate me for my incompetence at tying knots and doing other simple tasks. And what was even more unfortunate is that the mule I was on hated me even more than the cowboy. And, you know, all mules are stubborn, but this mule really had it out for me. And I don't want to give too much away except to say this adventure ends in an emergency room.
Yes, of course. Now, this book is about, you know, as well as a terrific adventure story, an exploration of the American character then and now. So talk a little bit about that for me.
Yeah, I tried to avoid what's true of many northern travelers in Olmsted's day and sometimes still now. They're almost on a southern safari when they go south of the Mason-Dixon line. They're focused on the exotic and the sultry and this strange land filled with strange creatures. And I certainly enjoy colorful, strange characters that I met, but I didn't want to make it all about that. And I was trying to, in a sense, take the temperature of the nation, or what Olmsted called the drift of things in this country. And I was traveling also in the lead up to the 2016 election. So politics were on everyone's mind. And so a lot of this book is in bars and diners and other such settings, talking about our differences. I was quite plain that, I'm a liberal from Massachusetts. I mean, you know, I'm a marked man in the South. I wouldn't, pass for a Southerner. And trying to have frank conversations across that national divide, as Olmsted did in the 1850s.
Well, you know how they say all politics is local. One of the great things about this book is that it brings home how much history is local and how people cherish it and love to talk about it, especially those Germans in the Hill Country. I thought those were some great, great stories.
Yeah, everywhere I went, I discovered history that I didn't know about and that isn't well known. And Germans in Texas, central Texas, was an astonishing story to me, that Germans at one time were about a quarter of the white population in Texas. And for the most part, they were anti-slavery, some of them strongly so. They opposed secession, and they formed almost a fifth column behind Confederate lines during the Civil War. A lot of them died as a result. And there's still a very strong German heritage that you feel in the Hill Country. And I found that wherever I went, obviously Cajun culture being a famous example, familiar to your listeners, but also the large Chinese community in the Mississippi Delta, other places. They're just the tremendous diversity and capaciousness of the South and really this whole country.
Well, along the way on this journey, we learn a lot about your character, too, and you hung in there all the way, so I'm very glad you made it out alive.
Yeah, except for my mule misadventure, no harm done.
Good. Well, we've been talking with best-selling author Tony Horwitz, whose new book is Spying on the South, An Odyssey Across the American Divide. You can meet him Friday, May 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. Tony, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. It was fun.
Brian Camp is one of my favorite New Orleans writers. I love seeing the city through his eyes. He's a graduate of the University of New Orleans MFA program, as well as the Clarion West Writing Workshop. In his first novel, The City of Lost Fortunes, we toured New Orleans with Jude Dubuisson, New Orleans' resident god of fortune, who was a genius at helping people find lost things. That book was named one of the best books of the year in Library Journal. Now, in the sequel, Gather the Fortunes, we learn about New Orleans from the point of view of Renaissance Reigns, a psychopomp whose job it is to usher souls to the underworld. Brian Camp, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Renaissance Rains and her quest in this book. And New Orleans lends itself so perfectly to the story of the undead.
Right. The funny thing about Renaissance is she wasn't the person that I intended to write this book about. In my head, there are three kind of pivotal figures in the city's mythology that I've built up. The next book that I wrote after Jude's book was going to be about somebody else. And I don't really have that tendency that some writers have, you know, where they say that their characters take over and they do things that are unexpected or anything like that. But by the time I got to the end of the publication process of that first book of City, she was just so compelling and so interesting to me that it made more sense to write a book about her than anybody else. And without spoiling too much of the book, of the first book, well, it's been out for a year, so. but, you know, she has some things happen. She shows up in the first book and she has some things happen to her, which is why she ends up as a psychopomp. It's not who she is at the beginning of the book. And so some of those circumstances I wanted to explore as a way of figuring out why I had done those things and as a vehicle for exploring some of the world that I had built.
Now, remind readers what a psychopomp is.
Oh, okay. A psychopomp is simply put, the guide who leads a newly departed soul into the underworld. And they're across mythologies, and they have various qualities, or some that are shared and some that are unique to different myths or cultures. Mm-hmm. But pretty much everybody has somebody waiting for you on the other side to help you make your way across.
Well, that's one of the most fun things you do in these books. You do these little passages that are like perfect comparative mythology lessons. You know what I mean? Those must be fun to write.
They're fun. They're challenging.
Because you don't want to go overboard.
Right. You don't want to go overboard. And I inevitably am going to get something wrong because humans are much too complicated to be that simple. Mm-hmm. And if that makes sense. And so while there are certain things that we share, it's very easy to say, okay, well, this figure is a water deity or something like that, and lump them into my little paragraph. And really, they have some other quality that makes them something else as well. One of the main criticisms I get from people you get the emails of like, you messed this one thing up or whatever. that's the real place that I get. Nitpicked about is, and you know, it's myth, so it means something to people. It's culture, and so the other part is, it's one thing to get it wrong a little bit, you know, in that way that I just described, and it's another way to get it wrong in terms of sensitivity, in terms of you know, just lumping somebody's real world living faith into you know, a clever little package for my little paragraph, and you know, insult somebody or you know, insult their entire heritage. And so that's another challenge to writing those things. But they are really fun to, I spend a lot of time, you know, flipping through books, honestly looking at a lot of Wikipedia pages and stuff like that, because Wikipedia is a fun source for just finding a bunch of connections that you might not necessarily have thought up on your own. So
I know, and you made me look up a bunch of things on Wikipedia, which was a lot of fun. Well, let's give folks an example of that. Why don't you read the beginning of the book when you're talking about death, and you draw on some really remarkable descriptions there.
When death comes, he carries a tool for harvesting grain slung over his shoulder, his skeletal form swallowed by a billowing black cloak. And she descends from the heavens, astride a magnificent horse, blood-flecked armor glinting in the light of a battlefield sunset, to carry a fallen warrior away to an everlasting feast. And he leads the way to the scales of judgment, with his human arms stretched wide in welcome, while his scavenger's eyes stare down the length of his jackal's muzzle, weighing and hungry. And she waits, either hideously ugly or unspeakably beautiful, depending on the way you lived your life, on the far side of a bridge that is either a rainbow or the Milky Way or both, a span that is either treacherous and thin as a single plank of wood, or wide and sturdy and safe, whichever you have earned. They are sparrows and owls, dolphins and bees, dogs and ravens and whippoorwills. They are the familiar faces of ancestors who have gone before. They are the luminous beings of impossible description, and they are the random firings of synapses as the fragile spark of life fades to nothing. He is a moment all must experience. She is a figure to be both feared and embraced. They are the concept that rules all others, a constant like entropy, like the speed of light. Death is both an end and a transition, simultaneously a crossing over and the guide on that journey, one that is unique to each individual and yet the same for all. Death is able to be every one of these and more, all at once without conflict or contradiction, because death is the end of all conflicts, is beyond contradictions, both nothing and everything. The only thing death has never been is lonely.
I love that. I think that's a great beginning. If that doesn't suck you in, you're in trouble.
Well, that was the idea.
What is it like for you to create this world? I mean, mentally, I have this vision of you in a room with lots of maps and post-its and sketches on the wall. And how do you do that? How do you keep them all straight?
Well, for one thing, so I have a big whiteboard in my office. And every once in a while, my wife will walk in and then just kind of back out because it goes A Beautiful Mind, you know, Serial Killer Murder Board, you know, it looks like that. Different colored inks and circles and lines. And sometimes that's just outline, you know, for plot and things like that. But sometimes it's organizing 20 years of being a mythology nerd into little categories. Yeah, so it's just something my brain kind of does, I think. There's not necessarily a system behind it or anything like that. It seems like it would be easier if it was. But I find connections to things. The first book started with a book, Trickster Makes This World. And so there were all of these various connections. That's Lewis Hyde's book, for the record. There are all these connections that he made about various trickster myths, and that kind of set me on the path of looking for those kinds of connections in other kinds of myth. Mm-hmm. And so death or destruction deities in this book and things like that. Those sorts of connections are just things that I tend to see and group together. And then doing it more deliberately for something like this, like I said, sometimes it's just compiling those early passages for a chapter. And those are usually dictated by something going on in the chapter. The main character of this is a psychopomp, so I start off by talking about death.
And what a psychopomp actually does with the soul and how it separates out the various strands.
Right.
Which is pretty gruesome and interesting.
So that idea, the idea that the soul is more than one thing, that, I mean, in the West, and it's something I talk about in the book, we, especially modern culture, we have this idea of you have your body and your soul, and that's the dichotomy. But for many, many cultures, that's not true or wasn't true before. The Egyptians, I think, had seven parts of the soul. There are Native American communities who say that the soul is three things braided together, things like that. And I very explicitly made up my own so that I wasn't explicitly drawing on one kind of culture or another to elevate or denigrate one thing over another. Kind of taking the idea from The Good Place. I don't know if you've seen that TV show, but kind of taking the idea that everybody gets it just a little bit right and pretty much everybody gets it mostly wrong. And so that's kind of my concept of the supernatural, if you
will.
That
must have been fun to sit around and think about. So what are the parts? Voice and essence.
Right. And luck.
And luck.
Right.
Oh, we've been talking with Brian Camp, whose second novel is Gather the Fortunes. You can meet him Thursday, May 30th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Brian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
In the great book of John, you're warned of the day when you'll be laid beneath the cold clay. Death will come from the skies and claim your pure soul when the time comes to die.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, there will be a release party for Sky Jackson's chapbook, A Faster Grave, Sunday, May 26th at 7:30 at the Dragonfly Poetry and Performance Space, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. R.D. Rolden discusses and signs his book, A Blind Man and His Monkey, Tuesday, May 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Mystery writer C.S. Harris, Candace Proctor, author of Who Slays the Wicked, and Michael Allen Zell, author of City Crystal Soul Man, discuss their latest novels Wednesday, May 29th 9th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. One Book, One New Orleans sponsors an interactive event based on the theme of truth in this year's selection, Vengeance by Zachary Lazar. Guests will receive cards with a character description on it when they arrive and will walk through different elements of the novel and write their perspective through the eyes of their characters. At the end of the event, everyone will discuss their thoughts about the novel and how readers understand truth. The event takes place Wednesday, May 29th at 5:30 at the Earl K. Long Library at the University of New Orleans. The Blood Jet Poetry Series presents Katherine Thompson and Brad Richard reading from their work Wednesday, May 29th at 7:30 at the Dragonfly, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. Today's guest, Brian Camp, discusses and signs Gather the Fortunes, a Crescent City novel, Thursday, May 30th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Tony Horwitz, discusses and signs Spying on the South, an Odyssey Across the American Divide, Friday, May 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. David Mizajewski discusses and signs Attracting Birds, Butterflies, and Other Backyard Wildlife, Friday, May 31st at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. The Symphony Book Fair is coming up. This takes place at the Lakefront Arena, begins Friday, May 31st from 9 to 8. There's an admission fee from 9 to 3 Friday only, and continues Saturday, June 1st from 9 to 8, and Sunday, June 2nd from 9 to 4. All proceeds benefit the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. Special collections this year include a collection of books on Josip Tito and Yugoslavian history, a large collection of Agatha Christie mysteries, a large inventory of children's books, a personal collection of meteorology, and opera and classical music on DVD and vinyl. The summer reading programs kick off this weekend at all area libraries. The Summer Fun Lunch Party takes place at every New Orleans Public Library branch during business hours Saturday, June 1st. Library Palooza, the grand kickoff for the 2019 summer reading program at the Jefferson Parish Library, kicks off from 10 to 1 Saturday, June 1st at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, and from 11 to 2 at the Jane O'Brien Chatelaine West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. This year's theme is a universe of stories. The Women's National Book Association also has a meeting coming up Saturday, June 1st at 1 at Paper Machine, 6330 St. Claude Avenue. To learn more about their book collection and printing presses from book artists Jessica Peterson and Yuka Petz, open to the public. Poets Deb Janerson, Elle Magnuson, and Paris Tate read at the Poetry Buffet, Saturday, June 1st at 2 at Ladder Library. Congratulations are due a number of local folks. New Orleanian Linda Prout is the winner of one of the first ever Todd Bowles Awards for Outstanding Achievement, named for the founder of Little Free Libraries. Prout, a retired teacher, has been tireless in her support of Little Free Libraries across New Orleans, now numbering some 200, in the post-Katrina era, and she's helped distribute thousands of books across our city. Congrats to Tulane alum Ellen Byron, who received an Agatha Award at the recent Malice Domestic Conference. She was honored for Best Contemporary Novel for her mystery, Mardi Gras Murders, the most recent in her Cajun Country mystery series. And in the run-up to the Anthony Awards at BoucherCon, several New Orleans crime writers are nominees. In the Best Novel category, November Road by Tulane alum Lou Burney, set in New Orleans during the Carlos Marcello era, and Sunburn by Laura Lippman. And in the Best Short Story category, Greg Heron for Cold Beer, No Flies in the anthology Florida Happens. And coming up, Bloomsday returns Sunday, June 16th at 11 a.m. at various venues around town. This annual reading of James Joyce's Ulysses is looking for those who'd like to read the book aloud or just come and listen. Check out the Facebook page Bloomsday New Orleans 2019 for more information. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. ¶¶